All right, hello everyone. Happy Monday, happy Labor Day. it's good to be here with y'all. I will be using the next hour and a half to look at the 7 steps to awakening and my personal journal, which are, you could say, my reflections on the 7 steps to awakening. What I'm going to do is give you a link to where we're going to start today. This is 320B. What's really interesting is, I don't know if any of you all were here last night, but if you were here last night, there was not a 320A and a 320B. This is a change to the journal. What happened last night when I was looking at number 320 in conjunction with the quote, I realized I missed what I perceived to be an important point. When I originally did the contemplation, there was an important point in the quote that didn't jump out at me. And yesterday in the teaching, that important point jumped out at me, and I felt I wanted to add it to the journal. So I changed what was originally called 320 to 320A. I didn't change anything in those words because I still thought those words were a perfect part of the reflection. But I added a 320B in order to capture the remaining point, which I thought was really important and worth capturing. So we'll start today with 320B. What I always like to do before I get started is take a moment of silence. So if y'all would join me in that moment of silence, I would appreciate it. Amen. So I see it looks like Barb has popped into the room, so I will give the link again for 320B. And again, this is the same quote that I read last night, which is coming from The Supreme Yoga, which is actually a book. So I'm looking at one book called The 7 Steps to Awakening, which is quoting another book called The Supreme Yoga. And in The 7 Steps to Awakening, I am on page 65. And this is quote number 320. Neither the world of matter nor the modes of creation are truly real. Yet the living and the dead think and feel they are real. Ignorance of this truth keeps up the appearance. So I mentioned that last night I had gone over what I'm now calling 320A. Last night I had gone over 320A, and what 320A focused on was even if we come to the point of, you know, fully realizing that we are the dreamer of the dream, but the way that realization is interpreted is with an interest in the dream, then what we might do is we might really hone our skills of manifesting, for example. And in fact, this has been a common practice in Hinduism for some time. People who really have strong manifesting skills are often considered, very powerful gurus. And you'll hear about gurus who can, maybe manifest flowers out of thin air or fruit out of thin air or whatever. And this is really honored. But the point that, when I was looking at number 320 from the Supreme Yoga, it says, neither the world of matter nor the modes of creation are truly real, which means even achieving this, what appears to be very powerful ability to manifest, has no real meaning. It's not real. it's still a part of the dream. And in fact, if you look at Ramana Maharshi's teaching, because people in India are so impressed with these types of powers, these special powers, one of the things that comes out of Ramana Maharshi's teaching a lot is that these are not important, that the only thing that is important is realizing the self. And here the Supreme Yoga seems to be making the same point. So last night when I read to you from number 320 in my journal, that was the focus. The focus was that, you know, even manifesting is not meaningful, that the only thing that is really meaningful is knowing the self. But as I went over that last night, I realized there's another important point here in number 320 that my journal entry did not focus on. And like I said, I wanted to go back and capture this other important point. So let me read this to you again, number 320 from the Supreme Yoga, and I'll show you what caught my attention last night. Neither the world of matter nor the modes of creation are truly real. Yet the living and the dead think and feel they are real. Ignorance of this truth keeps up the appearance. So the second part, that both what we would call the living and the dead, the people that you could say are between incarnations, some people might refer to them as the souls, between incarnations, both the living and the dead, believing they are real, or we would really, I think probably even a more pure way of stating this is the mind or the ego believing it is real, right? That's what keeps up the appearance of the dream, this belief in the ego or this belief in the mind or what the Course would call the wrong mind. This is what keeps up the appearance of the world. And so this part, the fact that the belief is what keeps up the appearance, was not in 320. So this morning I went back and I captured that in what I'm calling 320B. And that is the link I've given you. So let's look at the journal. Number 320B. It says it was added March 17th. It was added today, but I had to change the date in order to make it fall in the journal right next to 320A. So it was actually added today. Interest in the world keeps the appearance of the world going. Said another way, interest in the world keeps the delusion of self and world appearing real. With this said, the sensible means of awakening from delusion is to lose interest in the world and thoughts about the world. And that, of course, is not a new point. If you were here last night, you know that that point was also made in other quotes, in other reflections of other quotes. This point about losing interest in the world is a primary point in the teachings of Inner Ramana. But it was in this quote, and it was not included in the reflections of this quote. And it's such an important point, it's worth seeing over and over again. And so I felt like it was worth adding another entry to the journal to make sure I did not miss even one mention of this point, that really losing interest in the world is a primary part of our spiritual practice. Again, number 320B, interest in the world keeps the appearance of the world going. That one line itself is very important. You know, it's worthwhile for each of us to look at, how do I still have interest in the world? You know, where do I still have interest in the world? What topics or what circumstances fully bring me back into the world with a full belief that it's real and something needs to be done here? where is that going on with me? Because that is where the ego really still has a hold. And this is why the appearance of the world and the appearance of the self continues. So it's really worth looking at, each of us within ourself. Interest in the world keeps the appearance of the world going. Said another way, interest in the world keeps the delusion of self and world appearing real. With this said, the sensible means of awakening from delusion is to lose interest in the world and thoughts about the world. And as I said, this makes perfect sense. even to the thinking mind. This makes perfect sense. If the cause of the delusion is interest, then the reverse of that, losing interest, would help to release the illusion, correct? So, in practice, it may seem difficult, but it's actually simple. It's simple to see and understand why losing interest is an important spiritual practice. Let's scroll down underneath the reply and comment area, and you will see number 321. And you can click on number 321, and I will, of course, post this in the room for Clara and anyone else who wants to click on the link. So, number 321 in the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, this is another quote from the Supreme Yoga. As long as the highest wisdom does not dawn in the heart, the person revolves in his wheel of birth and death. That is the quote. As long as the highest wisdom does not dawn in the heart, the person revolves in this wheel of birth and death. So let's look at the journal, number 321. Pleasure and pain are inevitable for one attached to the world as the source of contentment. Losing interest in the world while focusing on constant isness is the answer. Everlasting joy, love, happiness lies in realization of that which is constant as truth and as self. So this is really the same point that was focused on last night. And it's just continuing to be focused on that. As long as there is a belief that in mind, and by mind, of course, I mean ego or the belief in a self. As long as there is a belief that in mind or in world, I will find happiness. And as long as I keep searching within my little self, you know, maybe I think that if I, you know, just change this about myself or just change this about myself, I will feel better about myself. I will be happy. Or if I believe that happiness is found in the world outside of me, as long as circumstances are this way or circumstances are that way, as long as I'm in a relationship, whatever, belong to a group, whatever, then I can be happy. As long as I believe that I can find happiness in little self or in the world, I am going to find some happiness. At least that's been my experience. You know, I do enjoy certain things and I find happiness, you know, when those things are present. But then when those things aren't present or when there seems to be an obstacle to keep me away from what I think I want as happiness, there's suffering. For example, most of us are pretty happy with a healthy body. You know, that's one of the basic things that we're happy with. Even if we were listing what makes you happy in the world, a healthy body is so basic that unless we happen to have a sick body, we might not even think to list a healthy body as something that makes me happy. You know, we kind of take it for granted. But healthy bodies don't last forever. And at the point where the healthy body is not a healthy body, at the point where cancer slips in or heart problems slip in or a stroke slips in, you know, if the healthy body was even unconsciously believed to be the cause of our happiness, well, as soon as the healthy body is gone, then there's suffering. So we suffer because we have cancer. We suffer because we have heart problems. We suffer because of our stroke, because we no longer have our healthy body, and we thought that a healthy body was a source of happiness. So even the most basic things that we take for granted, and we don't even notice that you know, I'm happy because. when those things all change, everything in the world changes. And so when those things change, suffering is inevitable. So sure, we can find happiness in the world. What we can't find is consistent happiness that does not at some point change to some form of suffering. That's the meaning of the word duality. So the only way for us to find consistent happiness is for us to have only one source of happiness. And that one source of happiness is our true self, which is also sometimes called God. That which is constant. That which never changes. And as we come to know that, and we see that that is our only source of happiness, then the appearance of things in the world can shift and change. Even the appearance of a healthy body to a sick body can shift and change, and we are not plummeted into suffering because we only have one source of happiness, and that source never changes. Therefore, our happiness is consistent. It's the only answer. So pleasure and pain are inevitable for one attached to the world as the source of contentment. Losing interest in the world while focusing on constant isness is the answer. Everlasting joy, love, happiness lies in realization of that which is constant as truth and as self. So that's number 321. Why don't we scroll down and click on number 322. All right, I've already put one person to sleep. Jamie's laying here snoring away. That's good. Number 322 from the Supreme Yoga says, "The materiality of the creation is like the castle in the air, an illusory projection of one's own mind, imaginary." Now, I don't really know what he's referring to as the castle in the air. Do you guys know what that means? It might be a part of a Hindu story or something. I don't know what that refers to. The materiality of the creation is like the castle in the air, an illusory projection of one's own mind, imaginary. So let's look at number 322 in the journal. "For one attached to the idea, I am creator of world and worlds, I can manifest whatever I desire, it is said, that which you manifest is not real. It has no meaning. It is the play of imagination. Lay down your plaything and seek for the enduringly real." So let's just look back at the quote again, make sure I didn't miss anything here. "The materiality of the creation is like the castle in the air, an illusory projection of one's own mind, imaginary." So for some reason in the reflection of this, I went to the one who feels power in saying, "I manifest this." The one who feels some kind of self, you know, some sense of self comes from saying, "I manifested this." The world comes from me. The world is a projection of my mind. But in saying that, there's a sense of self or a sense of power. And what's being pointed out here is that it doesn't even matter if you manifested it. It doesn't even matter if it's a projection of your mind because it's not real. That's like us being real excited because I had a daydream, you know. It's like that daydream was mine. I manifested that. You know, I projected that daydream. I projected all the details. I projected all the characters. Like, it doesn't matter because the dream wasn't real. So to arrive at a sense of self, because of the fact that the world is projected, that's just the ego's interpretation. The ego is still trying to maintain a sense of self. The point of these teachings is that the world is not real and therefore is completely meaningless. And the self, the little s self, the individual self, even the powerful manifester individual self, is not real. And so it's absolutely meaningless. Everything about it is not real. So the materiality of the creation is like the castle in the air. You know, the castle may seem like a place of power, but how could it be a place of power when it's not even real? It's just imagined. The materiality of the creation is like the castle in the air, an illusory projection of one's own mind, imaginary. So the only reason to understand that the world is a projection of our mind, the only reason to understand that at all, is to get the point that it's illusory and meaningless, that it's not real. And then, if it hasn't already happened, to cause us to start asking then, well, what is real? I want to know what is real, you know, and to turn our attention in that direction, away from the world. It's not to give us a sense of power as the dreamer of the dream, a sense of power of as one who has made all of this. That's the ego's interpretation. That's, as someone once used the term, big ego. And I think that's a great term. That's big ego that says, I did all this. It's not the point. You know, it's illusory. It's illusory. So for one attached to the idea, I am creator of world and worlds, I can manifest whatever I desire, it is said, that which you manifest is not real. It has no meaning. It is the play of imagination. Lay down your plaything and seek for the enduringly real. All right, let's go to number 323. It's kind of reminding me this, looking at the idea of the powerful manifester, is kind of reminding me of some of the warnings that Jesus actually puts early in the Course when he, you know, is teaching us that we are miracle workers, and he's teaching us that miracles can be performed through us, right? But he also teaches us that we should not consciously choose the miracles, that all miracles should be Christ-guided or Christ-selected. I don't remember the exact words. But that we should not consciously choose the miracles. And he tells us that if we consciously are choosing miracles, that choice can be, these words I do remember, severely misguided. And you can see how he's kind of warning us there against slipping into big ego. You know, big ego, I can heal. You know, big ego, I cause miracles. Big ego, miracles happen around me, where there's still that sense of self tied in there. So Jesus does caution us against that in the beginning of the Course, and we're seeing some of those same cautions coming now from these Hindu teachings. And if we're being cautioned by Jesus and by these Hindu teachings, this means this is a tendency in our, you could say, our shared ego mind. And so it's always helpful to be aware of tendencies in our shared ego mind. Probably for all of us, at some point, to some degree, those tendencies will rise up and want us to get married to them. That's what they want us to do. Those tendencies will rise up and want us to get married to them so that we do not continue the process of letting go of ego. You know, maybe we let go of ego here and here and here, but maybe we'll then grab onto ego in this place. And as a result, we've just traded, you could say, one type of ego or one ego tendency for another type of ego or another ego tendency, and ego gets to remain in place. So even if we feel like right now, in this moment, you know, I'm not this big ego, you know, I don't even friggin' know how to manifest, otherwise take joy out of it. You know, I haven't seen any miracles, you know, seem to be because of my presence or any miracles. I haven't seen any miracles work through me. You know, that's not a concern. That doesn't mean that someday that tendency won't rise up. And maybe some of the people in this room have already seen that tendency in their mind rise up. You know, all tendencies, all ego tendencies are shared. And so I think that it's really helpful to be aware of ego tendencies. It seems to me, again, it makes sense that if we are consciously aware of ego tendencies, that then we will be more alert when that tendency does rise up in us and try to get us to grab onto ego in a different way. It seems like until ego is fully let go of, until ego is fully released, we do go through a process of letting go of ego, which kind of leaves like a little vacuum there. But yet ego is still present. So it's not like we've let go of ego completely. You could say we've let go of aspects of ego, or we've let go of some ego tendencies, but ego is still present. And ego is extremely uncomfortable with that vacuum that is left, that emptiness that is left of the aspects or the tendencies that we've let go of. And what ego wants to do is rush in and fill that vacuum with a new tendency, maybe a more spiritual tendency because we're on the spiritual path. Maybe, you know, pride is a great one that ego really tries. Pride in our accomplishments, pride in our clarity. So it's really helpful to be aware of ego tendencies. And, you know, I am really grateful that we have teachings that point out these tendencies, even if they seem to be tendencies that are dormant in us now, or, you know, we might even have the thought dormant in me now. Pay attention, because what is dormant now will eventually rise up to some degree. And if we're aware of the tendency, then we can see that's just ego trying to keep me. That's all that is. That's just ego trying to keep from being let go. And we can then choose not to become married to these new ego tendencies that come to fill the vacuum of the tendencies that we've released. All right, so we're ready for number 323, the Supreme Yoga. When this notion of the object is firmly rejected and removed from the subject, then consciousness alone exists without even an apparent or potential objectivity. Okay, so this notion of object, an object, you know, it is a lot of things. You know, obviously the world itself is an object. The things in the world are an object. You know, we talk about the object of my affection. Typically that means a person, but who knows? For someone it might be an ice cream cone. The object of my affection. But even our thoughts are actually objects. We don't think of them as objects because they're formless to a degree. But even our thoughts are objects. And so when this says, when this notion of the object is firmly rejected and removed from the subject, what that is referring to is when we lose interest in the world and our thoughts about the world. That's what that's referring to. We lose interest in the world, everything about the world, and we also lose interest in our thoughts about the world and our thoughts about self, who I think I am, the little self, right? When we lose interest in all of that, then we have lost interest in object. When this notion of the object is firmly rejected and removed from the subject, then consciousness alone exists without even an apparent or potential objectivity. All right, so let's look at number 323 in the journal. What causes the illusory experience of I and world? It is caused by focus on the idea of object as the hopeful source of joy. In other words, the mere idea of object, given value or imagined purpose, creates the experience of I and world. This is why one must lose interest in the world in order to realize truth. As long as one looks away from the capital S self, apparent other than self exists. By looking only toward self, the illusion of other than self dies. All right, I'm going to let Jamie out, and then we'll come back and look at this. All right, about 5 minutes left. She'll knock when she wants back in.
Of course.
She's smart. Okay, so basically, you know, to make this simple, what this is saying is there's only two directions that our attention can go in. We can put our attention towards object, and again, even thought is object. Or we can put our attention away from object towards capital S self. And what's really interesting about this and what makes it seem difficult for some people or maybe even for all of us until a certain point is reached is that we're so used to looking at objects. In fact, it seems like the only thing we know how to do is to look at objects. That when we're asked to turn our attention away from objects and to look at the self, we find ourselves, or at least I did, still looking for an object. And in fact, I was very lucky because I had a very gentle inner guide that somehow knew when I was not yet ready to be able to look at nothing, you know, something that is not an object, right? And so it gave me a bridge focus. And in my case, the bridge focus was experienced in this way. There was a time when my heart opened. Some people say the heart chakra opened, but I'm not much into chakras. But, you know, maybe that's a good symbol. My heart opened. And when my heart opened, and it's remained opened ever since, when my heart opened, that gave me what I would call a feeling. I call it light. It's like a feeling of light within myself. And I could feel this heart, and it kind of shines like a sun would shine. It shines, and so I feel the light going underneath my armpits. I feel the light moving up into my throat. Often what they call the crown chakra, it tingles. So what happened before I was ready to begin to spend time focusing on nothing, no object is what I mean by nothing, is I was guided to turn my attention to this open heart chakra. And so it still gave me kind of an object. It was a feeling, but it was a feeling that kept me away from thought. It was a feeling that kept me away from the world. And so it was very helpful. It was a bridge. But at some point, an awareness began to come in that I was still focusing on an object and that now I was ready to begin to move away from focusing on an object to focusing on the self, which is not an object, and therefore it is often called nothing or no thing. So some of us will find that, you know, our inner guidance will help us find the ways to kind of step back from the addiction of focusing on objects by giving us another temporary object that is helpful, that is like a bridge that is moving us towards the ability to know or understand how to put our attention on no thing. That no thing, of course, is often called awareness. It's called self, but it's not an object. That's the point. It's not an object. So again, 323 in the journal says, what causes the illusory experience of I and world? It is caused by focus on the idea of object as the hopeful source of joy. In other words, the mere idea of object given value or imagined purpose creates the experience of I and world. And for most of us, if not all of us, that is the what we could call the starting point. The starting point is we know we want happiness. We know that consistent happiness is our right, right? We know that. We're born knowing that we deserve to be happy all of the time, but we aren't. And so we start trying to figure out how to get happy. Consistent happiness. Even if we experience a lot of happiness in this lifetime, and I did, my lifetime has not been one that you would call a lifetime of suffering. You know, I've had a very happy childhood, but it wasn't consistent, right? So there was always this trying to manipulate myself, change the self and the world, and move the self within the world so that it could get to the point of this consistent happiness that I knew I deserved, right? And this focus itself, that's what's funny, this focus itself of trying to get consistent happiness out of the world by always looking for happiness in the world is what keeps the illusion of the world going. So what causes the illusory experience of I and world? It is caused by focus on the idea of object as the hopeful source of joy. In other words, the mere idea of object given value or imagined purpose creates the experience of I and world. This is why one must lose interest in the world in order to realize truth. And we've been over this before, so this is probably making great sense. This is why one must lose interest in the world in order to realize truth. As long as one looks away from self, capital S self, the no thing, as long as one looks away from self with purpose, right, apparent other than self exists. And the apparent other than self is object, right? By looking only toward self, which is not object, the illusion of other than self dies. And again, this makes perfect sense if you keep in mind the truth of what we are. You know, divine mind. Of Course in Miracles would call it the Son of God. And if you realize that if the Son of God is continually at some level saying within itself, I want an object. I want an object. I want an object. There's going to be the appearance of object. The objects may change. You know, I didn't like that object. I want a different object. Nope, not that object. I want a different object, right? There'll be lots of change going on. But as long as the Son of God at some level is still saying, I want object, I think object is how I'm going to be happy. I need object. There's going to be the appearance of objects because we're talking about a divine mind here. But when the Son of God, or this divine mind, says, wait a minute, I'm not finding what I want in objects. I'm no longer interested in object. I just want to know myself. I just want to know myself, and turns attention away from objects back towards non-object. Well, then you can see how then, because that power was taken away, how then the objects would begin to disappear. It makes sense. The only problem with it, even though this makes perfect sense, and I think we can probably all see how it makes sense, the only problem with it is that most of us are still at a level of firmly believing, actually, I'm a person and I do need objects. There's the knock. I'm a person and I do need objects. So this belief that I'm a person and I do need objects keeps us addicted to looking for objects, which keeps the appearance of objects going. So again, the only answer is to realize our true self. That's the answer. It's the only answer we're ever going to find. It's the only way out of this is to realize our true self. So by starting to turn our attention toward ourself in whatever way our inner guidance is now guiding, that's the answer. By looking toward ourself, only by looking toward ourself will the illusion of other than self die. And that's the end of number 323. Why don't we scroll down and click on number 324. I'll put the link in the room. All right, and I'm going to take a drink of water. I'm reading what Teddy wrote. He says, the action of looking outside oneself as if there is something there gives your power to the thought of separation and produces a reflection, not extension. Yeah. And then he says, laughing out loud, and the belief that I am not a person who needs objects is the other side of duality, not the experience of being not that, but beyond and precluding. So what I think is really interesting about what he wrote in the second comment is the belief. You know, we're not here to take on new beliefs. That's another ego trick. I can read A Course in Miracles and I can read these Hindu teachings and they teach me I am not a person. And so I may take on a belief that I am not a person, but without the direct experience. And it is the direct experience that is needed. All spiritual practice, all true spiritual practice, is aimed at leading us to that direct experience. So the belief I am not a person isn't helpful. And in fact, we can walk around all we want saying, I'm not a person, I'm not a person, I'm not a person. And at the same time, we'll notice ourselves getting frustrated or angry because things aren't the way we think they need to be. The belief that I am a person and the belief that I need objects to be a certain way to be happy is still present. So what we want to do is follow guidance, follow spiritual practices that come to lead us away from the belief I am a person, right, and to the direct experience of knowing what we are. And Teddy writes, where the duality can be focused upon the single point of paradox, there the light can enter and experience can occur. Yeah. All right, let's look at number 324. I am reading from The Supreme Yoga. And here's the quote. The wrong notion that this world is real has become deep-rooted on account of persistent wrong thinking. And one thing that, you know, that pops up in my mind as a joke, because I know that I would never keep it up. So it's only a joke, but it's like a good point anyway. The thought that pops up in my mind is, wouldn't it be fun to count how many times in a day we let that wrong thinking pass by unwatched? You know, so how many times in a day does the thought, I am a person, does the thought, the world is real, does the thought, I need objects to be a certain way in order to be happy, in one form or another, because of course these core thoughts have many, many forms, but how many times in just one day do these thoughts pass through unwatched, unguarded, and therefore are just by default believed? And then we're talking about one day. And like I said, the idea of counting them sounds like fun, except I know I couldn't do it. It wouldn't be done. So we really can't even count the number of times in a day this happens in the unwatched mind. And then you take that one day and look at how many days there are in a year, how many years there are in a lifetime, and then who knows how many lifetimes there are. And you can see how consistently wrong thinking is believed. Very consistent. And that also, you know, really does a good job of describing why the world seems so real. Look how consistent we've been at believing wrong thinking. And it might also explain why, although, you know, Jesus tells us over and over that, you know, we can awaken right now, it only takes an instant, why that doesn't happen. You know, this wrong thinking has been consistently and persistently believed, and to some degree, even though that process may be starting to be undone in us, to some degree is still occurring, I'm sure, in all of us, I would think. So number 324, the wrong notion that this world is real has become deep-rooted. You know, I have some weeds that grow around here. You know, there's some weeds that I can definitely pull out by the root, right? But there are some weeds here that I put both my feet on the ground as firm as I can, and I grab a hold of that weed with all of my might, and I'm in a standing position, and I put all of my strength and body weight into pulling that weed, and I can't do it. There's just like no way I can pull some of these weeds, so then I have to resort to the chemicals to kill them because I can't pull the weed. Well, you know, that's what it seems like for some of us with this weed of the belief in the world. It's become very deep-rooted, and it, you know, even though Jesus says we can awaken this instant, it just doesn't seem like we can pull that weed. And so this is where the Holy Spirit comes in. The Holy Spirit is our chemical, right? And the Holy Spirit guides us in what appears to be gentle, in what appears to be a process that takes time, but it's applying the chemical of love and reality and right thinking to this weed that we have so persistently believed that the world is real and that I'm this little self. And it starts to loosen it. And when it's loosened sufficiently and we are fully ready, in an instant it will be pulled. How long does it take to pull a weed? Right? When it's sufficiently loosened, it only takes a second. You know, Muji, I saw a quote from Muji once said, we are acquiring the taste for truth. So this seeming process of awakening is really just a process of becoming ready. It's a process of allowing our willingness to get to the point of 100% willingness. But the awakening occurs in an instant. And the opposite of ready is continuing to believe the world fully. That's the opposite of ready. And in fact, just as I was about to say that, Teddy posted a correction. I loose this world from all I thought it was. Right? That's the correction. So the error is continuing to believe the world. The correction is losing interest in the world. Or I loose this world from all I thought it was. That's the chemical that is applied to the weed, so that the weed can eventually be pulled in an instant. So number 324 again from the Supreme Yoga says, the wrong notion that this world is real has become deep-rooted on account of persistent wrong thinking. Right? So let's look at number 324 in the journal. If the world is illusion, why does it seem so real? How many of us have asked that question at some point? If it's an illusion, why does it seem so real? Because thoughts about the world have been given interest, value, and belief over and over again. Since interest, value, and belief makes the world seem real, the opposite of interest, value, and belief lets its apparent reality disappear. Again, it makes perfect sense, and we're only seeing the same thing over and over and over again. You know, we're not, quote, learning anything new. But that's okay, because as we see it over and over and over again, it's like applying that chemical to the weed. And especially if we aren't yet at the point of losing interest, or if our losing interest happens, you know, a half an hour a day, but the rest of the day we're very, very interested in the world and in our thoughts about the world, it's really important that we see this message over and over again so that it sinks in so deeply. You know, just like the chemical goes into the weed. It starts at the leaves, but it goes into the vine part of the weed and down into the roots. We need this realization that losing interest is important to sink in so deeply that when something shows up that definitely would have captured our interest before, we find that we aren't interested. I'm not interested in getting involved in that conversation. I'm not interested in, you know, thinking about the many different ways this problem might be solved. I'm just not interested. I don't have that interest anymore. You know, one thing that Jasmine does a lot, you know, just because she does, is she'll do something, it could be anything, and she'll think that maybe this is something that Mom could get mad at me for, even though she hasn't seen Mom be mad in a very, very long time. That thought still occurs. And so she'll say to me, "Are you mad at me? You know, I just broke a cup. Are you mad at me?" And my response is that I laugh. And I say, I don't have the energy to get mad. Well, that's kind of what happens as we begin to lose interest in the world. We had no idea how much energy and effort we were putting into maintaining interest in the world, in maintaining the belief that this point, you know, that cup was important and you broke it, right? So now I'm going to get mad. That took so much energy. But we were so addicted to doing it, we didn't realize all of the energy it was taking. But as we start to lose interest and we start to realize the peace that is already there, that is present, the peace that we are, and we start to relax in that peace, then when something comes up that at one time would have grabbed our interest and we would have got involved with, it's like, I don't have the energy. I don't have the energy to pull myself out of peace and become involved in that. I'm not interested. You see, it's a matter of interest. I'm not interested in being there. Not interested in getting involved in that. I'm not interested in thinking about that. I'd rather just stay right here. If the world is illusion, why does it seem so real? Because thoughts about the world have been given interest, value, and belief over and over again. And we could probably say over and over and over and over and over, and I'll run out of breath before I get done again, right? Since interest, value, and belief makes the world seem real, the opposite of interest, value, and belief lets its apparent reality disappear. Is that starting to sink in? I mean, really, just not intellectually. I mean, it comes intellectually first. That's where it made sense. And so because it made sense intellectually, something in us relaxes and lets it sink in even deeper. Right? Just let it sink in. Losing interest allows the illusion, the delusion, to disappear. Losing interest. All right, let's scroll down and click on number 325. And I see Dove has written, "I will not value what is valueless." So another way of saying the same thing. And I'm going to read number 325 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, but it is quoting the book, The Supreme Yoga. Number 325. Hold on, I got to chew some ice that just went into my mouth. Okay, now I can talk. Number 325. What is known as liberation is indeed the absolute itself. What is known as liberation is indeed the absolute itself, which alone is. That which is perceived here as I, you, etc., only seems to be, for it has never been created. Again, what is known as liberation is indeed the absolute itself, which alone is. That which is perceived here as I, you, etc., only seems to be, for it has never been created. All right, let's look at the journal number 325. It looks like an inquiry came out of this contemplation. What am I? Am I a woman in a world that is more influential than me? This has been the belief, but is that what I am? Within my own experience, if I practice inquiry on the woman's thoughts, opinions, desires, and fears, can I agree that I am limited to that? Or is there honest realization that what I am is beyond what she appears to be? So I'll stop right there before I continue, because again, this is not merely a reflection, but it's an inquiry. And it's really looking, at least somewhat deeply, at the belief that I am this woman, this 52-year-old woman that we call Regina. And it's asking, can I see within myself? Because remember what Teddy pointed out earlier, it's not really helpful to let to, you know, at a conscious level to just adopt a belief, I'm not a person. That's not really helpful. That's just another belief. We need to have an experience. And so the purpose of inquiry is to point in the direction of that experience. By seeing within myself that there is some honest knowledge, not a belief, but there is some honest knowledge that I could not be this woman, in spite of the appearance. So again, this says, if I practice inquiry on the woman's thoughts, opinions, desires, and fears, can I agree that I am limited to that? Or is there honest realization that what I am is beyond what she appears to be? So let's pick a thought. I'm having trouble thinking of a thought. I'm going to go with food because food is so common. Let's pick a thought. And this is a thought I used to have. Let's pick a thought. Once I start eating sweets, I can't stop. This is a thought that many people have. It's a thought that's very common. Maybe it's not sweets. Maybe it's like chips, salty things. Once I start eating sweets, I can't stop. It's best if I don't have them in my house. It's best if I don't eat them at all, because I can't stop. This is a very common belief. Now, if I'm the woman, that's a fact about me. Once I start eating sweets, I can't stop. And in fact, I may have just spent the last 20 or 30 years proving that fact over and over and over again. You know, I buy a bag of Oreos, I bring them in the house, I think I'm just going to eat two, and before you know it, the bag is gone, right? You guys know about this, right? I continually prove to myself that I have the woman's limitations, that I am her. But what this is pointing out is if I really practice inquiry on that, you see, the reason that I feel limited to the woman's limitations is I don't practice inquiry on that. The thought comes in, you know, God, I got to eat another Oreo. I really got to eat another Oreo. I can't stop thinking about how much I want another Oreo. I got to get up and go in the kitchen and get an Oreo. And the thoughts are just there. They're never questioned. They're just believed. The next thing I know, I'm in there eating Oreos right out of the bag, standing up in the kitchen, right? But this is saying if I practice inquiry, if I move to spiritual practice instead of just blindly believing the thoughts, Is it true that I'm limited to these thoughts? And from my experience, what happens when I practice inquiry on any thought, I've never, ever not experienced this when I've practiced inquiry. When I practice inquiry on any thought, what I come to see is it is just a thought, and it is not me, and it has no power over what I am. So what that means is that by taking the time to practice honest inquiry on any thought, any opinion, any desire, any fear, you could say, I come to see that I am beyond that. I come to see that is not true about me. But what is the woman? Isn't the woman these thoughts, these opinions, these desires, these fears? Isn't that what makes up personality? Isn't that how we tell one woman from another woman, not just the body, but, you know, they have different fears, they have different opinions, they have different, right, desires. That's how we distinguish between one woman and another woman, one person and another person. So can it really be said that I am the woman if through inquiry I can come to see that none of her thoughts are really my thoughts, none of her opinions are mine, none of her desires are mine, none of her fears are mine? None of her limitations are mine. That may not define what I am, but it definitely shows I'm not the woman. Somehow I'm beyond her. I may be able to experience her, but what I really am is beyond her, right? So let's start at the top of 325 again. What am I? Am I a woman in a world that is more influential than me? This has been the belief, but is that what I am? Within my own experience, if I practice inquiry on the woman's thoughts, opinions, desires, and fears, can I agree that I am limited to that? Or is there honest, keyword here, honest realization that what I am is beyond what she appears to be? Can I detach from her thoughts, opinions, desires, and fears? If I can detach from her personality makeup, am I her? Or must I be something else? The experience of woman is here. But is experience the absolute and unquestionable evidence of fact? Now here's another good question which is worth pausing and looking at. I mean, I experience myself as this woman. I do not experience myself as Jay McCormick. I went to India with Jay for 3 weeks. I went to Israel with him for a week and a half, and I did not have one instant of experiencing myself as him. I experience myself as this woman. But does that mean that I am this woman? Is experience the absolute and unquestionable evidence of fact? Well, I guess what we need to look at in order to answer that is, have we ever experienced anything that we thought was true, only to find it wasn't true? Well, the answer is yes, every one of us have. You know, one of the clearest things that we can point to are nighttime dreams. When we are having a nighttime dream, we think that nighttime dream is true. We experience it. If there's something in the dream that scares us, we are scared, right? We may be running and running and running, trying to escape something. That experience is very real. When we wake up, we see that it wasn't true. So from that example alone, we know that experience is not the absolute and unquestionable evidence of fact. You know, because I experience myself as Regina and not Jay or not the dog Jamie, right? That is not proof that I am Regina. Because I know that experience can happen without what was experienced being true. I know that from nighttime dreams. Even beyond nighttime dreams, you know, we've probably all had the experience of hearing a sound or something and thinking, there's someone in the house. Someone who's not supposed to be here, right? Or someone outside the house. And we feel real fear from that, right? You could say it's a real experience. But yet there's no reality behind the experience. There was never anybody there. Never anybody in the house. Never anybody outside. So we all know that we can have an experience, but that doesn't make what we experienced a fact. So yes, I wake up in the morning as Regina Dawn Akers. I live her life. I don't live Jay's life. I don't live Jamie's life. But does that mean that's who I am? Is that beyond question? Is it absolutely true that I'm Regina? I think what we're seeing is that experience is not proof. In other words, there's at least room for doubt here. At the very least, there is, you know, there's some room for doubt. It's somewhat possible, right? It's at least somewhat possible that maybe I'm something other than Regina. And that's all that we need to really give. That's the little bit of willingness, or that's the little crack. You know, if we say, I'm absolutely this person, Regina, I know that because I experience it every day, boom, there's no opening for what we call spirit to get in and show us anything else. But if we can at least say, okay, I know that in dreams I dream this and I wake up, it's not true. I know that I can practice inquiry and transcend her thoughts, her personality traits. So even though I seem to experience myself as her every day, maybe it's not true. Maybe what I am is something else, and this is just an experience. That's all that we need to give at this point. So can I detach from her thoughts, opinions, desires, and fears? If I can detach from her personality makeup, am I her, or must I be something else? The experience of woman is here, but is experience the absolute and unquestionable evidence of fact? What if this woman does not exist? If she is non-existent, and the world is non-existent, am I non-existent? Well, a great way to look at this again is to look at a dream. Now, a couple of weeks ago, this is the first time I recall this happening to me, but it did happen a couple of weeks ago, which means I can now use it as an example. A couple of weeks ago, and I barely remember it now. I wish I could share more details with you, but a couple of weeks ago, I had a dream. And in that dream, I was not Regina. In other words, as far as I remember, although all of my dreams, you know, have been pure mind fantasy, I've always been Regina in the dream. So both Regina in the dream and Regina in what we call the waking dream. Always Regina. But a couple of weeks ago, I had a dream, and I was not Regina. In fact, I was a boy or a man. I don't really remember now, but I was male. And when I first woke up from the dream, I remembered all of the details of the dream. But what struck me the most is that I wasn't Regina in the dream. And that's the only thing I remember now. I have forgotten all of the details. But there was you know, I was a person, I had memories, I had some kind of a problem that needed to be resolved, and I had friends. Oh, I think I remember, getting into trouble. I think I was a young man, like a teenager, it seems like. And I remember being with my, you know, friends, the other guys my age, and I remember getting into trouble, you know, probably with the police or something, and my problem was, how do I get myself out of this? Well, that doesn't exist. The whoever the boy is that I was does not exist. Whatever the trouble is we got ourselves into does not exist. The problem does not exist. Therefore, there's no need to get myself out of that problem. None of it exists, right? It was just mind fantasy at night. None of it exists. The boy does not exist. But was there still somehow an I that was not the boy, but an I that was able to experience this dream? Was there some living something experiencing this dream, thinking, I am this boy and this dream is real? The fact that the boy does not exist, the fact that the dream does not exist, does not mean that there wasn't something that had this experience. Something. I mean, how could the experience be had if there wasn't something? So, you know, we may ask, you know, am I this woman? And I may start to see that I'm possibly or probably, depending on how deep I've gone with the inquiry, I'm possibly or probably not this woman. But is there existence here? Is there somehow existence that is deluded into believing I am this woman and this dream is real? And the only answer I've ever been able to come up to with that is yes. Something here exists. Not even a fantasy can occur without existence first. Not even a complete insane delusion can occur without existence first. So what if this woman does not exist, just like that boy did not exist? What if she is non-existent and the world is non-existent, just like that boy was non-existent and his problem with the police was non-existent? Does that mean that I am non-existent? And the answer to that is no. I exist. I may not know what I am, but I know that I exist. I couldn't even be wrong about what I am unless existence is there first. So I exist. This is known. I can reasonably question my existence as woman. I can see that that could be wrong. I can reasonably question the existence of the world, because if that boy's world did not exist, then maybe this world does not exist. His world seemed just as real. His problem with the police seemed very real to me. So I can reasonably question my existence as woman, and I can reasonably question the existence of the world. But I cannot reasonably question the existence of this presence. I. And in fact, you know, many of you know about the time when I was an apple, right? When Jasmine was eating an apple, and somehow my I awareness, what I am, became the apple. And this was not at all human. There was no thinking, there was no brain, there was no perceiving. Everything that is human was not there as I was the apple. Not even the perception of an apple was there when I was the apple. There was only the perception of light. And if you want to see more about this, you can look it up on YouTube. Regina Dawn Akers, I was an apple. But even in that experience, I was present. Not the thought I, because there was no thinking. There was no thought I. There was no identification. I am an apple. That was not present. But whatever I am was there, and it was fully experiencing itself as an apple without the human definitions and perceptions. Existence was there, I guess you would have to say. So I can reasonably question my existence as woman, and I can reasonably question the existence of the world, but I cannot reasonably question the existence of this presence, I. Not the I thought, not the I am Regina, but just this being. Something is here. Something is being. I exist is a fact that cannot be reasonably questioned. What am I? All right, let's scroll down and click on number 326. You know, I had another window that I was reading from up, so I did not see Cliff's comment. He says, "Oh my gosh, you were me in the dream." Yeah, I'm sure there's a few, of course you're not a boy anymore, but I know the boy's still in there. I'm sure there's a few boys that say, "Uh-oh, that was me. I was the one in trouble with the cops trying to figure out what to do." She was me. All right. Number 326, I'm going to read from the Supreme Yoga. In truth, this world does not arise from the Absolute, nor does it merge in it. The Absolute alone exists now and forever. All right. Again, the Supreme Yoga. In truth, this world does not arise from the Absolute, nor does it merge in it. The Absolute alone exists now and forever. Let's look at the journal. It may be helpful for a time to perceive that everything is God. This chair is God. That wall is God. The sun shining outside my window is God. This perception may be helpful for a time, but it is not absolute truth. In absolute truth, there is only that which is called God. There is no chair. There is no wall. There is no sun. And there is no window. It may feel precious for a time to realize one is merging with or disappearing into God. One may feel great gratitude for this experience, and the experience may evoke heartfelt devotion and discipline. This experience may be highly valued for a time, and it may be helpful, but it is not absolute truth. In truth, the self that appears to merge with God or disappear into God does not exist. The self is wholly illusory. The awakening process is not to be avoided or resisted, but in an absolute way, there is no awakening process. One is awake or one is dreaming. And the one who dreams is not real. So, again, I'm really happy that I had an experience that I was this boy just a couple weeks ago, because otherwise I might not have a really good example. So I'm grateful for the dream that I was this boy in trouble. So let's imagine then, let's look at this dream, and let's imagine that in this dream of this boy, I was this boy, when I was this boy, somewhere, someone said to me in this dream, "You're not really, you know, Cliff." We'll call him Cliff. "You're not really Cliff. You're Regina. Regina's having a dream that she's Cliff. But you're not Cliff. You're Regina. You're not in trouble with the police. You don't have any problems at all. You're in bed in Pueblo, West Colorado, asleep. And all you need to do to wake up, to get out of this apparent problem that you have, all you need to do to get out of this apparent problem that you have is wake up and realize you're not Cliff, you're Regina. Right? That's all you need to do. And maybe, even though it seems highly unlikely, you know, for the most part, because here are all my friends in trouble, here's all the commotion going on, and this is pretty serious trouble. It seems like I should focus all of my attention on this problem and try and get out of it, right? Maybe somewhere in me, though, there's just this something that says that's true. The only thing I need to do is wake up. The only thing I need to do is realize I'm not Cliff, I'm Regina, and the whole problem disappears. And so maybe what I start doing, because I start thinking, I think this is true, is I start within the dream turning my attention away from the problem. And I start turning my attention towards, you know, maybe this person or someone else that I think can tell me how do I wake up. I'm now, you know, I still really don't want to be in trouble with the police. I still want out of this problem, but I no longer see, you know, working with lawyers and defending myself and getting my friends to lie to me as the way out of the problem. I now see that the way out of the problem is to wake up and to realize I'm not Cliff and there really is no problem. So I start seeking out people that can tell me how to wake up. And I start getting different tips from people. And I start practicing those tips, right? You know? Someone starts telling me whenever these thoughts come in that you're Cliff and that you have this problem, you know, look at those thoughts and realize this is not true. I am Regina and I will awaken to being Regina and there will be no problem. And just keep saying this. Now, the funny thing about that, and I am a real voice, I am not an audio. The funny thing about that is, even that's an illusion. Because this boy, Cliff, in trouble doesn't exist. So this boy, Cliff, cannot awaken. It's still dream. None of it's true. The problem with the police isn't true. The apparent awakening process isn't true. Because Cliff isn't true, and his world isn't true. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. It's not anything we can wrap our minds around. The mind can't get that. But that's the situation we find ourselves in. Even our, quote, awakening process is part of the dream. It is not true. Right? Nothing exists here. Just like nothing exists in that world. But what's interesting about this paragraph, what's interesting about this journal entry is this last paragraph where it says, however, even though none of it's true, you're not true, your world is not true, your awakening is not true, the whole thing's not true, that doesn't mean that you should avoid or resist the awakening process. Right? That's not what that means. So somehow this Cliff in this dream is still supposed to follow the intuition of the awakening process until the Cliff and the dream completely disappears. Somehow that's still more helpful in the ending of the dream than to stay involved with the police and the lawyers and trying to get my friends to lie for me. And no one says that we have to fully understand all of this stuff. If we accept the premise that the dream comes from interest in it, then we can also accept the premise that taking our interest away from the dream is somehow helpful. And because the mind wants to be occupied, maybe occupying the mind with what we call spiritual practice, true spiritual practice, which is really pulling the attention away from the dream more and more and more, right? Pulling the attention away back towards the no thing more and more and more. What's really happening, if you think of the mind as a dream maker, whenever it's working, it's puffing out a dream, puffing out a dream. We're starting to turn off the dream maker by turning our attention on the no thing. And if we take our attention off of the dream maker and it quits puffing out this dream smoke, eventually, no dream. Right? It's just a symbol, but... And then there's no more thought that I'm Regina. There's no more thought that this world exists, because even that was dream. It was all coming out of the dream maker. So as long as there's a perception that I'm Regina, as long as that seems to have any validity at all, even an awakening Regina, a Regina that's much more awake than she used to be, right? Continuing to follow this awakening process in whatever way intuition is currently guiding is still the best choice, even though that's also false, not true. So back to what the Supreme Yoga said, in truth, this world does not arise from the Absolute, nor does it merge in it. The Absolute alone exists now and forever. Just like Cliff in the dream, the figure Dream Cliff did not merge into Regina, right? Heck, in the dream he could have even had that experience. I'm starting to feel more like Regina now and less like Cliff. I'm more and more Regina and less Cliff. I have less and less belief in Cliff, less and less belief in you know, this problem. But when the awakening occurred, poof, there never was a Cliff. There never was a Cliff. He did not merge into Regina. There never was a Cliff. The boy did not exist. So let me read this one more time and then we'll stop for today. Number 326. It may be helpful for a time to perceive that everything is God, or in Cliff's case, that everything is Regina. This chair is God. That wall is God. The sun shining outside my window is God. This perception may be helpful for a time. And we can see Cliff sitting there saying, those police are God. Those police are Regina. My friends are Regina. This whole dream is just Regina. And we can see how that might be helpful to get him less involved in the dream, right? So it may be helpful for a time to perceive that everything is God. This chair is God. That wall is God. The sun shining outside my window is God. This perception may be helpful for a time, but it is not absolute truth. In absolute truth, there is only that which is called God. There is no chair. There is no wall. There is no sun and there is no window. And we can see this in the example of Cliff. There is no police. There are no friends. There is no problem, right? It's not true. It's not that the problem is Regina. That was a stepping stone. There is no problem. That's the truth. It may feel precious for a time to realize one is merging with or disappearing into God. One may feel great gratitude for this experience, and the experience may evoke heartfelt devotion and discipline. This experience may be highly valued for a time, and it may be helpful, but it is not absolute truth. In truth, the self that appears to merge with God or disappear into God does not exist, just like Cliff never existed. This self is wholly illusory. The awakening process is not to be avoided or resisted. So, you know, that's what's really interesting about this, is we are being shown the difference between what we can call relative truth, which means what seems true to us but isn't true, and absolute truth. We're being pointed out the difference between relative truth and absolute truth. And we're being told that only absolute truth is true, so even an awakening process is not true. And then we are also told that this does not mean that the awakening process should be avoided. This does not mean we should fully throw ourselves into the dream. The awakening process is not to be avoided or resisted. But in an absolute way, there is no awakening process. One is awake or one is dreaming, and the one who dreams is not real. So that's as far as we're going to go today. Next Sunday night, we'll begin on number 327. I will be back on Friday with Lynn to look at A Course in Miracles original edition. Everyone, enjoy the rest of your Labor Day. And I'll see you later. Bye.